You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Mary Zinsner on behalf of the appellant SunTrust Bank, which was the garnishee in the underlying proceeding. With the Court's permission, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal time.
All right.
As this Court knows, this is the second time this case has been before the Court, and we appreciate greatly the grant of the petition. I want to start with there were three errors that the Court granted, and start with what I believe is the primary error, which led to what we view as a grossly inequitable result on SunTrust, and that is the burden of proof issue. It was an error of the trial court to impose burden of proof on SunTrust. As the Court realizes, SunTrust was the garnishee in the underlying proceeding. A garnishment proceeding is a creature of statute. And the parties to a garnishment have no greater rights than those set forth in the statute. Under the garnishment statute, a garnishee really is a stakeholder. It has a duty to remain somewhat neutral, not an advocate, but really a guardian of the funds, responsible to the court for turning over funds as well as responding to any inquiries the court may have as to those funds. SunTrust believes that the trial court really misunderstood this court's remand instructions.
One thing's for sure, he didn't do what we told him to do.
Well, that's right, Your Honor. That's one
of the... what you're leading with is probably one of your best arguments, and I don't blame you for doing that. The burden of proof is a serious question in the case. But without predicating this question on a factual recitation of this banking relationship, I think we all understand what it was about. There was $1.2 million went through the account, but some of it went through twice because of the unusual relationship between the subsidiary accounts and the master account. What we said was figure out the net number and make factual findings.
That's right, Your Honor. And I will say that SunTrust disputes that $1.2 million flow through the account, or that we missed or gave the debtor $1.2 million. You know, this is not your typical garnishment case. What was happening because of the zero balance account arrangement was that there were zero balance credits and zero balance debits. And so there were what this court previously described as revolving funds. And this court wanted to... the trial court, we believe, too, and it would have assisted this court greatly had the trial court done this, but just parse through those different credits.
Well, did he ever suggest it wasn't real money?
Pardon me?
Like SunTrust says it is? Did this court ever say that wasn't real money coming and going?
Your Honor, this court never did. This court referenced the fact that the account statements were alleged to be unreliable. And ordinarily, in a garnishment case, these statements do have an element of reliability. I mean, obviously,
well,
they're proven.
Didn't they produce the bank records that established how much money went into this account?
They showed.
And if it was real money and it went into that account during the garnishment proceedings, then why weren't they entitled to receive it?
Your Honor, what the statement showed were zero balance credits going into the subsidiary account, and then those same zero balance debits leaving the account. In addition to those revolving funds, there were also new deposits. There were a total of $2,142.40 of new deposits.
So are you saying, and I'm asking, that there never was the $1 million on the books passing through this account?
That's correct, Your Honor. That what was reflected were just deposits of credits as opposed to real funds being deposited. If you look at the account statements carefully, it shows there were no items deposited. What was deposited was credits. And we believe that's an important distinction, Your Honor. And again, we pointed out to the trial court what were the only new deposits, and those totaled $2,142.40. Had the court actually done, you know, the counting, which we believe this court had ordered it to do, you could have tallied up the $0 credits, tallied up the $0 debits, and found some difference, and tallied up the new deposits. But it's the $0 credits and the $0 debits were what this court describes as the circulating funds from account 61663, which this court previously held the judgment debtor was not entitled to, and so therefore the creditor was not entitled to. The judgment creditor can stand in no better shoes than the judgment debtor. So the operative question in this case is, had the judgment debtor walked into SunTrust Bank on any date during the garnishment period, could it have demanded $1.2 million in cash? And the answer to that question was clearly resolved in the trial court, and the testimony was no, he couldn't have demanded that amount of money. All that could have been demanded was the $15,140, which was held, plus the $2,142.40 that SunTrust admitted it also should have held.
Well, in the opinion of the court, we recognize that the funds deposited were possibly what we call revolving funds.
Right.
And that on remand, and that we defined revolving funds as the same funds repeatedly passing between G&D account 61663 and Deutsche account 95497. But we recognized when we heard this case the last time that there may be a defense that you had as to the revolving nature of the money, which you've referred to as credits. I'm not sure what difference that makes, but nonetheless, we recognize that things were being counted twice. And what we said to him is entertain all the defenses that they raise and make findings of fact. Are there any findings of fact in this case coming back up?
Your Honor, I believe the only finding of fact that the trial court made was that the accounts were a confused mess. What appellee's counsel likes to do is point...
We would probably affirm him on that.
What the appellee's counsel would like to point to are quotes from the court at subsequent hearings relating to the bond, et cetera, where there were some statements by the court that, you know, I don't buy this illusory money thing. Well, those statements aren't in the trial record. They aren't in the orders of the court. This court speaks by its orders. And as a result, there are no factual findings that this court can rely on in terms of determining what are revolving credits and what were the new funds. We contend that under Huff, this court's opinion from 1925, that the Huff case teaches that the burden of proof always rests with the judgment creditor, that the garnishee never bears the burden of proof, that when there was a failure of proof, when there was no evidence that these were actual deposits, that there was $1.2 million absconded with, when that burden of proof was not sustained by the judgment creditor, the garnishment should have been dismissed.
Well, counsel, if I looked at those statements, I were the trial judge, how would I make the distinction between actual money going in and going out and what you're calling a credit?
You could do that, Your Honor, by looking at the actual statements and tracking both the deposit side and the withdrawal side. And the deposits which are credits are clearly labeled credits. And then you see on the withdrawal side the zero balance debits that match up with those $0 credits. As I said initially, bank account statements are traditionally reliable in a garnishment proceeding because of the fact that there is an unlinking of the account. The account's basically frozen. And so what you typically see in a garnishment action is an account statement where the garnishment hits and then there are no further deposits and no further withdrawals from the account. But because there was no unlinking in this case, the computer just referenced and that there were funds and or credits being transferred in and out of the account from the master account to the subsidiary.
Well, I mean, don't say funds or credits. Do these records show that over $1 million in funds went into this account?
I don't believe they do, Your Honor.
It just shows a credit.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. My understanding of how this worked was that obviously companies are trying to get the benefit of overnight interest and all those kinds of things. But you had a subsidiary account and a master account, and a number of subsidiary accounts that had the same master account. And that on a daily basis there was a sweep of the subsidiary account, correct?
You're right, Your Honor.
And the only time the master account put money back in was when there were liabilities that the subsidiary had to pay.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that's the reason why the money that had already come into the account, arguably, it may be more, it may be less, depending on accounting, was redeposited into a subsidiary account in order to meet the ongoing liabilities of that particular subsidiary.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, that's how I understand it worked.
Yeah.
Because you're going to create a mess in this case, didn't it?
It did, Your Honor. And the reason there were the transfers is because there was a hold on the account in the amount of the garnishments, which was $700,000. So it caused the master account to think that the subsidiary account was overdrawn and transferred these monies in. Had they been unlinked, those transfers never would have occurred. And I want to address Your Honor's point about the deposits again and where these were funds. If you look at both the account statements for the master account and the subsidiary account, the balance on a daily basis never, ever, ever equaled anywhere near $1.2 million. It was always in the subsidiary account, it was always, you know, $68,000, $70,000, and in the master account, the daily balance was in the $100,000 range. So this account did not see that type of money, the millions of dollars. That's what the account officer testified to, that neither the subsidiary account nor the primary account had this type of money. Had the debtor walked in, it could not have demanded $1.2 million. And so that's the faulty predicate on which this judgment rests.
You have 3 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, H. Charles Dean for the appellee, Judge of Creditors, TS Business Parks. I think where, and to address Your Honor's question about what did the trial court do and what factual findings were there, I think the trial court did make factual findings. When it says in the order for payment, I find that $1.2 million reached this account. And the trial court found that to be actual money.
But apparently, correct me if I'm wrong, that finding was through the prism of the burden of the preponderance of the evidence on the bank. Am I wrong or right on that?
I don't believe it was. I think, and I'd submit, that the burden of proof for proving the initial liability and initial quantum of damages was always and should have been on the creditor. And we met that burden. We submitted the bank statement, which Ms. Zissner admits, which the Court of Appeals has said prove that burden even beyond a reasonable doubt. That is the status of the account on any given day. And so that proves the bank statement, that proves the balance and those deposits that reach the account on any given day. And we know from Virginia National Bank in the Bernardini case that deposits are reachable by the garnishment.
But his question was the burden of proof question.
And we get to the
and,
burden.
And I'm reading from the opinion letter. D&G, I conclude that neither D&G, really not involved, because they weren't a party in this case. But
they were the non-party master account holder, yes, sir.
Right. The parent, if you will, of
yes.
The subsidiary. I conclude that neither G&D nor SunTrust has satisfied that burden of proof. Now, how do you get around that?
Well, I think what the court's referring to in that contest, and I addressed this in my brief, is really what SunTrust is making here is an affirmative defense, much like is made in Monahan or a mitigation of damages type situation. They're not disputing they don't have liability. They're not disputing that this isn't their account. What they're disputing is their own accounting as set forth on the bank statements.
No, what they're disputing is that no one has a right to the money when the debits and credits are flowing through, including the debtor or the creditor.
Well, exactly. What they're asserting is that their own bank statements are wrong.
Well, they don't have a burden. I mean, there is no affirmative defense that you've put this lien or this garnishment on my account, but I can prove, if you let me put on evidence, that there's no money in there. Well, the burden's always on the other side to prove that there is money in there, and exactly how much.
I think, Your Honor, what we have is, taking it to the logical extreme, we've got, if this were a situation like Huff, where the creditor puts on no evidence and just puts on the garnishee and says you can't believe them, which is what happened in Huff, then yes, I'd agree with that. But we don't have that here. What we have is the creditor putting on the bank statements that show actual deposits, and as the trial court found, real money reaching that account during the garnishment period.
Then why didn't the trial judge say, well, obviously the burden of proof is on the plaintiff in this instance, and they sustain their burden by showing me the accounts? And I hear some retort from the bank about the nature of debits and automatic credits, but I'm not persuaded by that, in which case you would probably get an affirmance by order. But that's not what the trial judge said.
Well, I think what he's responding to is, and maybe you end up in the same place, but I think what he's responding to is this affirmative idea that this is revolving money, that this isn't real money. This is something different than simply a denial of liability. This is an affirmative assertion that these are revolving funds. And as we see in cases, one like Monaghan, or impossibility or undue influence, all kinds of affirmative defenses, that burden is on the defendant. Moreover, as we see in the case that the appellant cites, the Faulkner Circuit Court case of Spreadbury, whenever you have a situation where a party is claiming that funds in an account should be allocated differently, the burden's on that party.
They're saying there are no funds in the account, that the nature of the automatic debit credit flow through is completely ill-fitting the common law of garnishments, or rather the statutory law of garnishments, in that in reality there are no funds. That's their first point.
All due respect, they're not saying there are no funds. They admit initially to $15,000. That was initially agreed.
Talking about the debit credit funds.
They say now that there's another $2,000. We know from the record in this case and from the prior record that there were funds in the master account, which we don't get to access directly, but that those funds were drawn down into the subsidiary account. So we know that some of those credits were backed by actual funds. And what the trial court found is all of them were.
Based on what evidence? From either the statements or any testimony?
Well, the statements themselves show actual funds, and none of the testimony refutes that those are actual funds and actual credits coming in. In fact, we know from the master account that there was at least $100,000 in there. We know from other exhibits that there were interim account balances. We know from the statements themselves there were ongoing account balances. The account never dropped to zero. Money would come in. It would be subject to the garnishment. And then somehow that money would leave. And that's form of garnishment law, is when there's money coming into an account, it shouldn't leave the account. And that's exactly what happened here, is money then left the account. And at that point, we have to determine, and the remand instructions were, determine if any of this was the same money coming back in. And what the trial court said is, no, I don't buy that this was illusory money. I think this was all real money.
Perhaps the trial court should have heard testimony on that question, and then maybe you would have found out the answer. I mean, what you're basically saying is that you can garnish, if they're right, that you can garnish a ledger entry showing a credit. That's what I hear you saying, if they're correct about what the nature of that is.
And I think that's the key, is they're correct. But that's a factual determination the trial court made.
Yes, a factual determination you make when you apply the proper burden of proof.
Which I think the trial court did.
Okay, well, suppose hypothetically that's wrong. Just assume it's wrong. Wouldn't that mean we'd have to remand it?
I don't think it does, because, again, the trial court, even if you wanted to say that the burden was on SunTrust merely to go forward, which is that the Bad Hat case, which they cite, The trial court wasn't convinced of the explanation, and he makes that clear in his ruling. He wasn't convinced the explanation was reasonable. He found the bank statements were more persuasive than the testimony, and that's exactly what we expect trial courts to do, is make credibility and persuasiveness determinations based on the evidence in front of them. And he simply found the bank statements and what was recorded on the bank statements by SunTrust computers to be more credible than the testimony of the self-serving testimony of assistant general counsel for SunTrust. And so once we have that factual determination, that becomes the facts of this case. And that's, we can't say that's plainly wrong.
But why is it self-serving? I mean, what do they care where the money goes? If it's a lawful process of garnishment, it goes somewhere else? And then if it's a... I mean, so I don't get why...
It would be self-serving in the sense of it would minimize the liability or debt owed by their customer. Certainly SunTrust would prefer... Again, I'm assuming, but certainly SunTrust would prefer the money goes to their customer rather than some third party who they have no.
They're this huge bank; they have millions of customers. I mean,
But again, that money is shown on the bank statements, and the trial court just determined the bank statements were more credible than that testimony. And you can call it self-serving or not, and perhaps I shouldn't, and I apologize for that. But he simply made a credibility determination that the bank statements were more reliable. And once you reach that factual determination that there's actual money behind there, and you don't buy this illusory money thing, and specifically finding that $1.2 million that belonged to the judgment debtor came through your bank, which the trial court expressly states, that's Bernardini. That's Virginia National Bank. The money is there. And then it becomes incumbent upon the party saying something different than the money being in that account to prove it. And that's Sprinkler. And that's exactly where we are. And so that's why the trial court said, on that issue, the burden of proof is on them. And once we reach that, to reach the other two assignments of errors, once we get there, that there are no illusory credits, that there's $1.2 million in there, the rest of this flows by statute. If you look at 656 and... 565, the court proceeds under 516.1 as if SunTrust had admitted to $1.2 million. And then under 516.1, the court orders delivery of that estate, and if it's not delivered within 30 days, has the option to enter judgment. The court entertained that option. SunTrust said it was not going to comply with the order of payment, so the court entered judgment, and it had no other choice at that point. And once you accept that factual conclusion, which there's ample evidence in the record to support, the judgment flows organically under the statute. And so hearing no other questions, I thank the court for your time.
Thank you very much. You have 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Just very briefly, Your Honor. Obviously, it's our position. The creditor was awarded a windfall in this case. I'm not quite sure how the court can both find the statements are a confused mess and rely upon them to determine that there is $1.2 million in the account.
And well, if it's a confused mess and you have the burden of proof, that's how you can rely on it. But if you don't have the burden of proof, you don't.
Right, and we don't have the burden of proof, Your Honor, because this is not an affirmative defense. As this court well knows, affirmative defense ordinarily have to be especially pleaded. In a garnishment case, a garnishee doesn't even necessarily have to file an answer with the court, because if it has the funds and is holding the funds, it just tenders the funds to the court. It only answers if it's not holding any funds. Your Honors, I urge you to go back and look at the Huff case. It clearly sets forth the burden of proof rests with the judgment creditor. And when the evidence is unreliable and there has been no sustaining of that burden of proof, it should result in dismissal of the garnishment.
And what I understand your opposing counsel to say is they did meet that burden of proof by producing the financial statements that show money into the account that establishes a prima facie case, and it's on you to knock it out, and the court just didn't buy your evidence.
Well, Your Honor, what happened was they put the statements in, then we put the testimony of the SunTrust witness on, which was not self-serving at all. Again, he was simply responding to the court's inquiry and counsel's inquiry, and as a neutral garnishee, and testified that there were simply credits and debits going back and forth, no real money being deposited in the sums alleged. And having controverted that evidence, then the burden shifts, the burden of presenting evidence, not the burden of persuasion. The plaintiff always had the burden of persuasion. But the burden of presenting evidence then shifted back to the creditor to establish that the SunTrust witness was wrong. And there was never any evidence presented, Your Honor, that the witness was wrong. They didn't call the judgment debtor to say, oh, yes, we absconded with $1.2 million of deposits that the bank should have held. They're not even here, Your Honor.
Can you just give just one page from the appendix as an example? What would I look for to see that these bank statements reflect credits as opposed to actual bona fide or whatever the right word is, deposit, just as an illustration?
Look to the subsidiary accounts, which are found at page 235 through 244 of the appendix. For example, on page 237, there's reference to, right in the middle page, it says total items deposited, zero. Deposits less credits, 29. So all of these entries on the other page, except for the ACH new furniture payments, which the witness described, they were all $0 credits coming into the accounts, and so you could track them back and forth. Your Honor, I would ask that the court be specific in its remand instructions, and again, we believe there have been two examinee proceedings already. There has been a failure of proof. We'd ask that if the court is inclined to enter a reversal order, that there be very specific instructions with respect to dismissal of the garnishment, except for that additional $2,142.40, which we admit.
Thank you for your argument. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.